Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios, East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 317 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
Doing awesome.
That's it?
That's it.
Have you had any tangles with any spiders lately?
No, but I have considered exterminating services from my home.
Have you been experiencing a low air quality index lately either?
Very much so. The air purifiers are working very hard in the office, and I don't have any at home, but yeah, they're working overtime here. There's controlled burns, and there's just poor air quality for the next several days.
Do you think you might want to invest in one?
I have considered that, but I think I have to invest first in extermination service. Now, I've only been in the house 18 years, and I've never had an exterminator, so it might be time.
See, I got nothing to say on that one. I got nothing to say. How are you? Chance? Larry, where's Chance?
He's not able to be with us tonight. He's having some computer work done in his office, and he just doesn't feel like he can be with us because of the work that's going on. He doesn't have his office available.
So please go over to your favorite podcast app. Oh, wait. Before, I don't want to forget saying this. Someone messaged me over on Reddit asking about, well, where's the podcast feed on the Amazon platform where you could go, hey, A-word, play the podcast. And I don't know. It's supposed to be there. I went and verified and everything looks okay. I will follow up though, but it hasn't been there since like, I don't know, February. I didn't know it even died. I don't listen on that platform. So two things, I'm working on that one. And two, if it's supposed to be somewhere and it's not where you want it to be, let me know so I can try and funnel the podcast over there. You know, I release a podcast, the main feed, and it's supposed to get distributed out. I can't control where it goes from there. Hopefully it goes everywhere. So anywho, that's all I wanted to say on that. But please like, subscribe, favorite, star, 5-star review, all of those things. Did I cover everything with that, Larry?
I believe you did.
And then if you can go over to Patreon or all those places, if you can go over to Patreon and do us a favor, and even for as little as a dollar a month, you could become a patron. That would also be incredibly appreciated. Well, tell me, sir, what are we doing tonight?
Since Chance is not able to be with us, you only have Mr. Gloom and Doom. And we have two clips from the late Justice Scalia, if they work, to play. We have a letter to read about an organization I'm not familiar with, but it was interesting. I thought I'd throw it in. And we're going to do a deep dive into a question sent to us from a prisoner in Arizona. The question is about interstate compact transfers and registration requirements from one state to another. And then you threw something in about an article that I'd written, and I don't know where you fished that out from, but anyway, we're going to talk about that article I'd written about the importance of elections. And I took all the other things out, so hopefully we can get through this in a shorter period of time.
Well, how come then it's still 12 pages? Oh, well, because you're long-winded. Okay, now, look, I went back through, and I checked configs and button pressing, and I tested this. If it doesn't work, I just quit. I'll have to hire someone to fix it. But I'm pretty sure that when I press this button that says Scalia Clip 1, it'll work. But before I do that, tell me what I'm playing.
Well, he's got a clip where we divide it up from the same program, but we divide it up from two different clips. He speaks about strict interpretation, and he explains how that would be a disaster. And then in the second portion, he speaks about the limitations of self-government and the amendment process. And again, it's about his judicial philosophy of not legislating from the bench.
Okay, well, let's roll clip one. It's gonna work.
When you call yourself a textualist, that's not the same thing as the popular notion or the popular term that I think many lay people know, which is strict constructionist. Can you explain that?
Oh, yes, I have never been a strict constructionist and advise no one to be a strict constructionist. Strict constructionism gives a bad name to textualism. For example, If you were to interpret the First Amendment strictly, you would come to the conclusion that Congress can censor handwritten letters because it says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. A handwritten letter is not press, it's not speech, So Congress can, of course, that's not what it means. Speech and press is meant to cover the ground of expression.
If you are going strictly by the text, you would say, well, if Congress, being brilliant as they are, they would have said, they would have included the other things such as letters and so forth. It allows him the flexibility to get to the outcome that he would want to be on this, but it's not real consistent with textualism because the text doesn't say anything about handwritten letters, and he admitted that. But it was just trying to point out a little bit of an inconsistency on that particular clip.
Of course he's being consistent, but that's what someone else would say about another thing that's near and dear to their heart of some kind. Of course it doesn't mean that. But then Scalia would say, since they didn't write that, so how would they mean that?
That is precisely what he would say.
That feels very inconsistent, as you said. And I will call it hypocrisy.
All righty, well, but his supporters won't agree with you.
Clip number two, what do you want to say here?
Oh, I think they just go with the clip, then I'll explain it.
Let me cite a critique of your fair reading of the text sort of rule from a former colleague of yours, retired Justice David Souter. And he said he thought the fair reading model had a tenuous connection to reality. He said it's one thing to have the Constitution say senators must be 30 years old, but that there are these broad guarantees in the Bill of Rights, like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, equal protection of the law, that the application has to evolve over time, and that otherwise the Constitution cannot fit the modern age.
Yeah, it doesn't have to evolve over time. If it was up to the courts to make it evolve over time, there would not have been a provision for amendment. It contains a provision of amendment precisely because the framers understood that they may find some provisions in the future are not good and additional provisions are needed. Look, what the Constitution does, those provisions especially that guarantee individual rights, it takes certain matters out of the background rule of democracy, which is the majority rule. Now, there are exceptions to that, and most of them are in the Bill of Rights. The majority won't rule about speech, about religion, about quartering troops in homes, and so forth. Every one of those things is taken out of democratic self-government. And whenever you leave it up to the courts to read in a new exception, you're leaving it up to the courts to limit the scope of self-government. So it is not that I think the Constitution cannot be applied to new phenomena, such as television, such as telephones, as far as free speech is concerned. Of course it can. You have to figure out how those principles apply to new phenomena. But as to the phenomena that existed at the time, this is what originalism consists of. With respect to those phenomena, it doesn't change.
So, well, now, I think we've done enough on Scalia to hold people for a while. If you have presidents who appoint Supreme Court justices with that view, then there's not going to be any evolving standards of decency. It will be up to you as citizens to rally support from your fellow citizens to go through a constitutional amendment process if you think something should be unconstitutional or vice versa, because there's no such thing as evolving standards of decency. The death penalty will never be deemed unconstitutional by the court with like-minded justices as Scalia, because he says emphatically that it was not unconstitutional at the time, and you can't evolve your way to that result. You have to legislate your way to that result.
Well, if I may present to you the way that I understand how this works, is that if a state can deem that this is something that they want to have, and then another state says that they aren't in favor of it, and it breaches some level of civil liberties or constitutional privileges, then that's how things would start getting pushed up to the Supreme Court. And the way that I understand, if we roll the clock back, I don't know, like what, 50 years is when this really started to become an issue for certain people, is that there were two ladies who wanted to be married, and they just kept driving that bus and kept driving. And eventually, in like 2012, I think, is when same-sex marriage was constitutionally provided for.
Well, I think it was a little bit later, but keep going. I think it was more like 2015, 14, 15, but go ahead.
Well, it was somewhere before when I was released from summer camp, which was 2014. But that doesn't really matter. I'm not even trying to go into that particular subject. That's not my point. But what I understand that has happened is that the states say no, and then another state says yes, and you have something like health benefits or survivor benefits, and now you have a really big conflict that you got married in this state and you went to another one and they don't recognize your marriage. And that's where the conflict comes from. And that's what ramps something up to go all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rules and says, you can do this thing, and it becomes allowed by the Supreme Court, and then everybody else has to follow the rules. It's when the, what am I trying to get at, is the conflict between two areas where they, where people are fighting for it or fighting against.
Well, and without opening up this Pandora's box about same-sex marriage, the debate was because under Scalia's doctrine, there would be no evolving standard of decency. But in this particular situation, the benefits you described didn't exist back in those days. Very few people received the type of benefits that you're talking about when there was no Social Security, so there would have been no Social Security survivor benefits. Very few pensions, I think, would have existed in those days. I wasn't around. That was a little bit before, about 100 years before I was born. But I don't think a lot of the things would have existed. So the new phenomena that came into place, but without opening up the door too much, the conservatives brought this mess on themselves because they were the ones who passed the Defense of Marriage Act. And the Defense of Marriage Act is what ended up being struck down. So DOMA was what the issue was in that case. And the conservatives created that monster because they knew they could win at the Supreme Court, and they didn't. And you should be able to at least admit that that's funny.
It's definitely funny. But still, I'm just trying to create the idea that even the way that Scalia put it, I thought was very interesting, that this is just what it is, where like you can't, the Third Amendment is you can't quarter soldiers in your house. That's not allowed. The government can't even say, hey, this platoon of people, they're going to live in your house now. And we don't have any debate about it. It's just not allowed. It's unconstitutional to do it. And if your governor says, we're going to put these soldiers in there, it's just not allowed. It's a violation of your constitutional right. I've never heard it framed in a way that he's saying there's no democracy on these 27 things.
Well, but what you're saying is not true. The Supreme Court could come back and they could overturn their decision that they made that you're referring to in 2014 or whatever it was. If you get enough Scalia's on the Supreme Court, he was not in agreement with that decision. He did not think there was any constitutional right to same-sex marriage. He thought that you need to go out and legislate it. So it could rapidly vanish as a constitutional right just as quickly as it got there.
Well, I'm very much in agreement with his idea that we have the amendment process, and that's why we create it. So we should amendmentatize ourselves to allow for, you know, whatever you pick your subject. But I know how hard it is to get it done, to go, it's got to pass through Congress. Then what is it? 2/3 of the states?
I think it's 3/4 of the states, but still, you wouldn't have to do everything by constitutional amendment. You could pass a law outlawing banning capital punishment. You don't need a constitutional amendment to stop putting people to death. You just got to have the will to do it. But the people are not willing to abolish the death penalty in many states. They're happy as a lark that we put two or three to death this past week, and I think some of them were rather gruesome. Was that new potions they're using because they can't get their traditional drugs?
Barbaric activities.
Absolutely. But the people could put an end to that if they wanted to. They do not want to. And that's going to be in a segment very soon about what the people want and what the people don't want.
Okay. And I just want to say, if what I would imagine happens, if the states that are aggressively pursuing capital punishment would file a challenge to the Supreme Court saying that you can't do that, that's unconstitutional to say, I can't nuke people.
Well, I don't think Congress would pass a law trying to ban states. They would pass a federal ban under the federal system, but the states would still be free to have their own death penalty.
That's true.
And we have a lot of states that do have the death penalty. We don't use it regularly, but we use it more often than I would like to use it, because if we make a mistake, it's very difficult to bring those people back.
It's really hard after you've nuked somebody to go, whoops, sorry, undo.
Yeah, there's no reverse key in that one.
All right. Well, I'm going to move over and read this letter that William wrote. Is that where we are?
That's where we are.
We appreciate that you took the time to inform us about the organization named Find the Children. Prior to your letter, we had no knowledge of their existence. You can rest assured They understand their existence depends on scaring people into believing that their children are in extreme danger of being snatched by a sexual predator. Their very existence is dependent on donations, which flow from individuals who believe they're doing good by donating to save children. The last statistics we've seen are that the number of child abductions by strangers is approximately 100 annually. The inflated number of 700,000, if true, would include non-custodial parents who take their own children without permission.
Yeah, that was kind of the order it was intended to be, and read the letter from the Dropbox, but that's all right. That was our response to his letter.
Now, the way that I understand that 700,000 person number is that, so Larry, if you and I were to share a child, well, you know, we've done some Big Brother activities. Well, this is going to sound terrible, but we have custody over a child and then we have a falling out. And you're supposed to pick up Junior from school. And then when you get there, he's not there because I got there 10 minutes earlier and I picked Junior up and I'm off. I don't know. We're going to Niagara Falls or something to go check that out. And you're like, holy crap, where's my kid? And so you immediately dial 911 and you say, my child has disappeared. And of course, that gets reported as the 700,000 people. Someone in chat is doing, can you do me some quick math? How many children per day would it be disappearing at 700,000 per year divided by 365? What is it? That's about 2,000 people per day would be, 2,000 children per day are just vanishing.
It would be an awful lot. And the real number by stranger danger is somewhere approximately 100 annually, which is too many. It's one too many if it's yours. But with 330 million people to have, that's statistically almost negligible. And it's like, really, we're spending all this energy creating an imaginary boogeyman. And I think it was funny because I think he used boogeyman in the letter. And that's one of my favorite terms. I hate people who use imaginary boogeymen to create fear. There's enough to be fearful about without imaginary boogeymen. So, but yes, this is fundraising at its finest. Find the Children is exploiting this number and scaring people. And if people did a tad bit of thinking, and you and I have these conversations, and I say, well, even if you don't know this stuff, just think it through. You go 700,000 divided by 52. Let's see. That's more than 10,000 children a week, because that would be 520,000. We would have
It's 13,461 per week.
We would have so many children lost that this country would have to go on lockdown and have martial law. You don't need a lot of education to figure out that this is bogus. You don't need any special training. You just need analytical skills at a very minimal level to figure out how crazy this is.
The Dropbox article that you put in, the letter, it states that every 40 seconds, a child is reported missing. And it states that this total is up to 2,000 children per day. Find the Children gives no time context about how these children are reported missing, but it implies that they're all kidnapped by PFRs. Somehow, they claim 700,000 children disappearing this way is not only hysterical, but contradicts the Department of Justice and law enforcement statistics. Sorry, I didn't read the letter, but that's in there.
That's all right. Point is well made. This is a fundraising thing. That's all it is.
I'm not trying to point out that so much of this is fake news. The news is just reporting this because they got a press release from a place like this. And all you'd have to do is go look at some Department of Justice statistics to find whether these numbers are true or not. And you would immediately find that, yes, 700,000 children are reported missing, but they're not disappearing. And it's 900
absolutely
of them are returned.
But it's like so many things. It just requires a little bit of thinking to work through it. You don't need a lot of education when these ridiculous, outlandish assertions are made. When people say this is the worst economy, worst inflation in our life, you can say, well, let's see, worst inflation. If you're not old enough to remember the 70s when wage and price controls were imposed under conservative Republican administration because inflation was so bad, if you're not old enough to remember that, you can just Google worst inflation U.S. history and see what pops up. That's all you've got to do.
Come on, you know Google is a liberal bias entity, and that's why they have the alternative Google, right?
Well, but like I say, if you lived through the 70s, you remember wage and price controls. You know, it's not the worst inflation ever. It's crazy talk. But
before we go to the main event, you wrote an article about the importance of legislative actions. and I saw that posted online. Do you want to give me a brief rundown of that article?
No, because I like the article. So sure, let's go into it. The importance of legislative elections.
Oh, whoops, my bad. Legislative elections.
Well, as I stated in the article, many of us facing draconian laws frequently bemoan the harshness of the punishment and registration requirements that flow from being convicted of a PFR type offense. While the laws can certainly be too harsh and disproportionate considering their online conduct, the laws originate from we the people and how we the people choose to cast our votes. In addition, those we elect tend to vote consistently with the views of their constituents.
Now, you said it's a pivotal year for legislative elections?
Yes, I would call it a pivotal year. Every 4 years is pivotal for legislative elections. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, 44 states will be holding legislative elections this year. This means that voters will be choosing their senators and representatives for a total of 4,712 legislative seats. And that's sourced by the NCSL, and we have the link provided. Since the United States is actually 50 separate sovereign jurisdictions, each state decides what the appropriate amount of punishment should be, as well as their own registration requirements. This means everyone should listen very carefully to those on the campaign trail who wish to represent you in your state capital. When candidates campaign on a law and order platform and they promise that they will be tough on crime, it should not surprise us when they vote to make penalties more extreme. Examples would be surgical castration and imposition of the death penalty for those who commit certain sexual offenses. A few states have already enacted such harsh laws, and more are likely to do so in 2025 unless we choose not to elect them.
Now, you know, Larry, that some people say it just doesn't matter, and they will impose harsh laws regardless. It doesn't matter which candidate you vote for, and of course, in the end of it, my vote doesn't matter.
Well, my response is, I say nonsense. It does matter. Some key points to understand when you cast your votes in November are that those who espouse extreme views on the campaign trail are exceedingly difficult to compromise with once they have won their election. Our two-party system needs balance rather than lopsided control by a single party. The party that holds the majority, I'm giving you a little bit of education of how the system works. The party that holds the majority in each legislative chamber is the party that largely controls the legislative process in that chamber. The majority party names the committee chairs. It controls the legislative calendar. In addition, committee membership is awarded based on the makeup of the overall membership of the body. As for a hypothetical example, a state that has a Senate with a total of 50 members would be organized under the control of whichever party has 26 or more members in that chamber. So let's say a majority of 50 would be 26 or more, right?
Right. So 50 divided by 2 is 25. So you would have to have 26 or more.
Okay. So you're in control. But if you're in a closely divided chamber like that, and you happen to have a few moderates on each side and not extremists on each side, like we've gotten with our polarization of our parties, then you're going to have to reach across the aisle for getting something passed. But the next important is the ratio of members at each party. If one party controls 40 of those 50 seats, that party will have the same ratio in legislative committees as well. For example, in that hypothetical, 80% of the committee seats would be awarded to the majority party. So a committee of 10, say you have a judiciary committee in the Senate that has 10, 8 of those will be held by the majority party and 2 members of the minority party. And committees are of major importance because that's where the public is permitted to have their most input. In fact, most states allow public comment at committee hearings. So if you want more compromise, don't elect these lopsided majorities, because if you do that, you've got a 10-member committee and 8 of them are from one party, there's no need for them to pay any attention to what the other two members of the minority say. Who gives a damn? We've got the votes.
Now, I'm going to go off script for just a second. I want to ask you something that you put in there about the legislative calendar. Did you tell me what that means?
It means in terms of when things are going to be voted on and how the process is going to move along. If you're the majority party, when Mitch McConnell was running the Senate, before the Democrat Party got the majority, Mitch was the one who could have kept the First Step Act from being voted on. And he did keep it from being voted on for quite some time until Jared Kushner applied a little bit of pressure through, I'm sure, the presidential, through the executive branch. But things move according to when the majority wants them to move. And if the majority doesn't want to move, they can bottle them up. And the larger the majority is, the more the easier it is to bottle up the process.
Now, sorry about piling onto Mitch there. The reason why there were something like 400 judicial appointments during the Obama administration is that McConnell sat on them and would not even bring them to the floor. That's also the calendar that you're referring to, isn't it?
That would be the process, yes. When the when one party, like at this stage of Biden's presidency, there won't be any more confirmations of federal judges. It's too late in his term. They'll just sit on them. He can make appointments till he's blue in the face, but they won't consider them at this point. And then those will be held over. And if Trump wins, he'll get to make the appointments. If Harris wins, she might get to make the appointments, assuming that the Republicans don't have strong control of the Senate. If they were to win a huge majority, they might just decide to sit on her nominees as well.
Now, I know that someone will tell me. I know that person is going to send me a message on Discord probably sometime Sunday evening. That's his prerogative to sit on them. And it's not his constitutional duty requirement to bring them to the floor. He's not obligated to do it. That's just part of what his job can be.
I don't know that I can answer that. I don't think that the Constitution has any clarity in one way or the other. It says with advice and consent of the Senate. I don't think anybody in the Founding Fathers' days would have anticipated that they would say, oh, well, we don't like this president, so we're just going to sit him. I don't think anybody would have thought that way, but you know, like I say, that was about 100 years before I was born, so I didn't hang out with those people, but I can't imagine they would have contemplated that. And I base it upon, for decades and decades, they didn't do that. This is a relatively new phenomenon of bottling up judicial and important nominees, nominations. It's not that, it's not been that common. It was done. Lyndon Baines Johnson tried to elevate Abe Fortas to Chief Justice in 68, mid-year 68. And that was bottled up by the Democrat Party because the conservatives that wore the Democrat Party label back in those days didn't want another liberal Chief Justice. And so when Warren announced he was stepping down, they said, if you're going to elevate another liberal, we're just not going to confirm that. That was, and then it didn't happen again very often after that. You remember the Bork scenario back in 86, 87, when they didn't confirm Bork, but they brought him up for a vote. He went through the process, and he got voted down. They didn't bother to give President Obama even any courtesy at all with having a hearing and even considering the nomination. This is kind of relatively new of just totally sitting on nominations.
You also stated something about some balance and that's important. Why is balance important?
Again, if I'm trying to work out a deal, I need people that are reasonable on both sides. If I am trying to do something for criminal justice reform and I'm in a lopsided conservative legislature, I'll never even get to the point of compromise because they'll usually just kill it straight out. But if I'm close, if it's a closely divided legislature and I can reach out to a couple of Republican moderates, if I'm in a 70-member House and I've got the opportunity to pass something with 36 votes, 37 votes, and there's a few moderates on that side of the aisle, I can go work with them. If they're all radical, rabid right-wingers, they just don't believe in compromise. And it works the same way on the lefties. It's really hard to compromise with extremists. Their mind is made up and you can't get through to them. You need people that are more grounded in the center of reality. And it's very difficult to work with lopsided legislature.
Well, very well. You can head over to narsal.org and find that. And there will be a link also in the show notes if you want to check that out. It's there over on Narsal. You can find it on the homepage as one of the feature articles. Who knows how long it'll be there until somebody else writes an article and knocks Larry off the front page.
All right. Well, I'm glad you're watching the internet.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Now, on this next part, you didn't tell me who this came from. I just said, I just made it so-and-so.
All right. It's on the letter. His name is whatever it's in the letter. But you know, we received it from a prisoner.
And so here it is. From so-and-so. I've been listening to the Registry Matters podcast since the beginning of the program. Can't you people find someone other than Larry to answer listener questions? I have a question about transferring my probation from Arizona to Florida. I know he will be, he being you, Larry, he will be Mr. Doom and Gloom as usual if he answers the question. My understanding is that Arizona requires annual registration. I will have 152 days of probation to serve when I'm released by Arizona, and I want to move to Florida to be near my family, who can offer me assistance. Can you explain this process, please, of transferring to Florida, and can you confirm that my registration will be annually? And so, what do you think of his plan? Don't transfer to Florida. There. That's the end of this segment. I've answered it. Do not transfer to Florida, especially while you're under supervision, but please don't transfer to Florida.
This is actually a fantastic question because this issue impacts many of our constituents and stakeholders. And there is a formal process for transferring state-imposed probation or parole from the sentencing state to a different state by following the rules of the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. Should I get more into the nuts and bolts of that process? Because yes, he could do that.
Please, yes, Larry. I haven't had a chance to roll my eyes in the back of my head lately. This thing always baffles me. But yes, please go into the nuts and bolts.
Okay, well, he's going to not like part of the answer, but it's not me being doom and gloom on this. It's because there is some doom and gloom, but the nature of his supervision will not permit transfer. Before I get to the Interstate Compact, we can tell you that PR4 supervision is very strict, and the conditions of supervision imposed in Arizona would follow you to Florida if you were to be able to move your supervision there. But you're not going to be able to, since your letter states that you have only 152 days of supervision. You will not be eligible to transfer for that short amount of time remaining. One must have at least 6 months of supervision or more to be eligible for transfer. But your registration requirements are determined by the state of residence, which means if you do make it to Florida, Florida will control your registration once you're there. And Florida's registration requirements are more onerous than Arizona's, as far as I know. And you will have to register in conformity with Florida law if you move there. So forget everything that Arizona that you read about once a year. You total that, throw that in the dumpster, and you start looking at Florida registration if that's where you determine to go.
Okay, I was looking back at the FYP archives, and we discussed this at length in RM 156. You stressed they resolved a case with a negotiated plea. This can strand their client. I'm sorry, this can... Can you revisit that? This can strand their clients if they transfer? What are the conditions where they would get stranded?
Well, you don't need to be looking at FYP archives.
Sorry, I forgot what I was supposed to say to all that.
Well, we know we did the stuff. We don't have to look at our archives, do we?
Isn't that why they're there, though? If for me to not reference them from time to time?
So, but yes, the person can be stranded in the state of conviction once he or she does a plea because of Interstate Compact rules. A person convicted of a PFR type offense has to wait for approval to live in an address rather than just being told to go back and take up your previous residence. And so hypothetically, if you're giving a probated sentence and told go back to the state of residence, that normally happens if you show the sentencing court and the probation authorities that you were living there at the time of the plea. But because the address might be in an exclusion zone for a PFR, the CAOS rules permit the receiving state to 45 days to investigate where you would like to live, which means the person needs deep pockets for temporary lodging in the state of conviction while they wait that approval. So when you go to do a plea and your attorney said, I've got this great deal, you're going to get probation, you're going to walk out with probation, make sure you carry enough money with you to pay for 45 days of lodging in case you get stranded there, because it may take the receiving state up to 45 days. And then what would be even worse would be if they find it's in an exclusion zone and they have you submit another address.
You know, I've kind of been through that a time or two of that 45 days. It's not like you submit the paperwork on Monday and you get it back, I don't know, that weekend or even the following Monday. You'll probably get it back at 43, 44, or 45 days.
Correct.
Well, all right. Are you telling me that attorneys, when they are hired to represent you, that they don't know the law and they end up stranding the client in the new location?
Yes, it occurs more frequently than I'd like to admit. The attorneys do that very thing. And when I was training public defenders, I worked very hard to make sure they understood how not to have this happen, to minimize this happen. You can't stop it from happening, but try to minimize the impact of this happening.
And if we go back to the person who wrote the letter, how can he get the ball rolling? Is there a form for him to fill out? Something online? Like www.interstatecompacttransfer.com or something like that?
Well, let me stress that applications seeking interstate transfer are submitted by supervising authorities, not the offender. So please do not contact the offices of the Interstate Compact in Kentucky. Step one is to get with your caseworker in Arizona and submit the application. And those seeking to transfer supervision should keep in mind that no state wants to supervise another state's PFR offenders for fear of potential liability should the person reoffend. Therefore, interstate transfers are often denied for relatively minor reasons. This means that you or a loved one should do as much homework and research as possible prior to applying. You should attempt to find out if the proposed dwelling meets the requirements of the receiving state, meaning the state you're living in. You're going to go do a plea on the next door state, find out what all your state requires as best you can. And since he's in prison, he's going to be reliant on others. But for example, a house could be too close to a school or a park or someplace where children gather, and that could mean that you cannot live there and your application will be denied. And simply don't just research registration laws, because supervising authorities can and often do impose additional restrictions other than what's in the law. Like New Mexico, we don't have any prohibition. You can live anywhere you want to live. But while you're under PFR supervision, they won't let you live near a whole lot of things that you could normally live with. So if you're under supervision, you have a different set of rules in terms of the registry requirements. You may have residency restrictions that are not in the registration law.
Okay. Now that you've said all of that, this is where my head always explodes. Who sets the conditions of supervision and which registration requirements control? I think a person who only has to register once a year in Arizona and everyone in Florida registers quarterly. Can you help with if it's going to be annual? Is it going to be quarterly? Is it going to be all of that? Tell me what happens. Break that down.
Well, it's really easy. The registration will be governed by Florida if he makes it to Florida at some point. So everything that his public defender or his hired attorney told him in Arizona about you'll have to register once a year for the rest of your life would be put straight into the wastebasket, because he's not in Arizona at that point. He's in Florida, and he will register as Florida directs him. And if he doesn't like to register according to Florida's requirements, he didn't have to go there. It's kind of like you taking your car to a state that has smog inspection from a state that didn't have smog inspection. If you don't like having to get your car smog inspected, don't go to that state. But yes, that will be part one. Florida will be in control if he makes it there. But in terms of his supervision, that will be dual control. Arizona will have determined how long he's going to be under supervision. They will have determined their conditions. But Florida gets to have a second bite at the apple, but only limited to conditions, not length of supervision. So if he comes to Arizona, say that they would let him transfer 152 days of probation. They won't, but if they did, he would only have 152 days when he got to Florida. Florida could not change that. But when he got to Florida, Arizona could have told him, you've got the right to travel the entire state. When he gets to Florida, they can say, you're confined to Pinellas County or whatever county he's living in. Because if that's consistent with how they supervise their offenders, they're allowed to put additional special conditions on the supervision as the receiving state. And you have to agree to those special conditions. And if you don't agree to them, you don't have to agree to them. They'll decline your transfer. But it's not that complicated. Your conditions will follow you. They were imposed by the state that imposed the sentence on you. Those conditions go with you.
We've talked about this whole process before, and I thought you have a right to live. Let's see. And we've talked about the interstate compact transfer stuff before. And are you saying that a person doesn't have the right to live in a state of his or her own choosing? Are you saying he cannot live in Florida? That seems to defy everything I've ever been taught about the United States Constitution. We don't have the freedom of movement between the states?
Yes, that's partially true. Unfortunately, a person does not have the right to live anywhere they want while they're being punished. Beyond that, as I said, he's ineligible to transfer due to having only 152 days remaining on a sentence when he's released. Unless that's been changed, he will not be eligible to be transferred. It's too short of a period. But if he did have a longer period of time, he would not have the right to go to Florida. Florida is doing him a favor. He's serving an Arizona sentence, and Florida's doing him a gracious favor, letting him move there. They don't have an obligation to take care of Arizona's offenders.
Can you revisit one little piece? Can you, if someone is still on probation or parole, is that considered still being punished?
Yes, that's the part of his punishment. The registration is a civil, non-punitive regulatory scheme. But while he's...
Yeah, I think I probably need to go to the laugh track about the civil regulatory scheme. Non-punitive, that part.
That is not part of his punishment. He could go to a state, theoretically, that didn't have registration. But his punishment does not change. It will go with him. The conditions Arizona wanted him to follow. I've used this cliche before. Wouldn't it be great if you could extinguish your punishment by leaving one state and going to another state and they could take it off of you? Wouldn't that be a fantastic country?
Yeah, that would be awesome, which would also mean that if you moved to a state that had extra punishment for what you did, you know, that the thing I always bring up is felony jaywalking, and they have the death penalty for it. Well, you move there and you were convicted of it in the previous state. So what you going to do now?
Yep. So
now you just talked about a fee for submitting the application. And if you've got to submit it multiple times, that would get super expensive. How does this person, if they're in prison, how are they supposed to pay that fee?
Well, that is true. The Interstate Compact permits states to impose an application fee, and the fee schedule is on the website, the ICOS website. And the full compact, as well as their rules and advisory opinions, are also on that website. And some states impose a fee up to $250 or more. I think that's the highest I've seen, at least $250. So you're right, it could be very expensive to apply for a transfer.
Now, a person that's in prison, they're between a rock and a hard place. There's this fee to apply, and there's no guarantee of acceptance. And then the person is going to have to, I don't remember what the whole place is called, where you have somebody in the prison write a check off of your books, and you got to file the application, you got to get them to pay this fee. That would be diabolically complicated.
That is correct. There is no guarantee of acceptance. In fact, the odds are that the state you're applying to go does not want you or any other PFR to transfer in. This makes it extremely difficult to transfer, but transfers are approved.
Now, does it make any sense to call the probation or parole authorities in the location where you would like to go?
Intellectually, it makes sense. Unfortunately, the reality is they're not working to transfer more criminals, offenders into their states, in particular PFRs. So most of the time, they're not going to be all that helpful. But yes, intellectually, it makes sense.
Now, is it likely that Arizona will let him apply? And more importantly, is it likely that Florida will deny him?
That is what I'm saying. Arizona would like to let him go probably, but with that 152 days, he's not eligible. But Florida doesn't want him.
Now, let's assume that a person makes it through all the hoops and is accepted for transfer. Then he or she picks up a violation while on supervision in the new state. What happens? Do they just extradite him?
That's probably one of the most misunderstood components of the interstate compact. The person is not subject to extradition because he or she has already waived extradition as a condition for being permitted to transfer.
Now, let's assume that a person makes it through the hoops and is accepted for transfer. Then he or she picks up a violation of supervision in the new state. What happens? Do they just extradite them back?
Well, it's a retaking, which is different from an extradition.
You, sir, are so hung up on legal mumbo-jumbo. No wonder people get completely frustrated with you. I'm frustrated with you. What is the difference between an extradition versus this so-called retaking? You still get hauled back to the original state, don't you?
Well, no, not necessarily. An extradition is a very limited legal proceeding. An extradition does not permit any argument on any issue other than the identity of the person and whether the demanding state has their paperwork in order. In other words, it's a fugitive demand seeking the correct person, and the appropriate state officials have signed that demand, and which usually, I think, includes the governor's office. But before a retaking can occur, the person's entitled to a more robust process called a probable cause hearing before a neutral hearing officer. There are so many instances where people are denied this probable cause hearing, and that could have prevented them from having to be returned. And they just simply sign a waiver and agree to be returned because their attorney that was representing them didn't understand the difference, him or herself. And they said, you just ought to go on back there to Alabama and get this all straightened out. And you could probably straighten it out in Idaho with never having gone back to Alabama if it's a very weak violation. You might win it with a finding of no probable cause, and then you're done.
And then you just get to stay where you are? But then how does that happen? It would seem as though the courts would... Don't the courts understand their own processes and what you're entitled to? Wouldn't they?
Not true. Often they have no process in place for these probable cause hearings.
Would you be so kind to elaborate on these probable cause hearings?
Oh, they know what the probable cause hearing, but they don't know that a person on an interstate compact supervised offender who is being supervised in their state is entitled to this probable cause hearing. But it goes back for decades. The history of the due process requirement as it pertains to a person serving probation, other than the state of conviction, is a very long one, dating back to 1973. The requirement that, I was quite old in 73, the requirement that a person be provided with this hearing is in the interstate compact. It's Rule 5.108. The origin is the Supreme Court decision in Gagnon versus Scarpelli from 1973. Gagnon was the second ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court regarding the rights of people on probation or parole. And the first was Morrissey versus Brewer in 72, which dealt with parole. But these PC hearings are critical because you could save yourself a whole lot of bother of being stuck in the state. And what's funny is you get sent back to the sending state and you lose your residence in the receiving state, and then you've got to apply from the sending state to come back. Now, can you at least admit that that's funny?
Not funny, Larry.
Well, no, you get sent back to Alabama because you didn't get a probable cause hearing in Idaho. Alabama decides to remit you to probation, give you credit time served, or they find that you didn't violate or whatever. And then you'd like to go back to Idaho. You have to apply all over again because your residence has been broken, and you may have lost that Idaho residence because 6 months passed and you couldn't afford to pay rent while you're sitting in jail in Alabama, and you've got to start all over again. Isn't that funny?
Not funny, Larry. If probable cause hearings have been required since 1972, well, why aren't the people getting them?
I wish I could explain that. My guess is that nobody in the system wants to do more work than they have to, and as a result, no process has been built uniformly across the country to facilitate these hearings.
Now, would you go back through and talk about the two U.S. Supreme Court cases that you were just referencing?
Well, Scarpelli is the one that's most on my mind. He was sentenced in the state of Illinois for a conviction out of Wisconsin. He was serving probation in the state of Illinois, and the Wisconsin court had sentenced him to 15 years, and they suspended that and gave him probation. And after the probation sentence began, Scarpelli was arrested for a burglary while being supervised in the state of Illinois, and Scarpelli's probation was revoked by the Wisconsin Department of Public Welfare subsequent to his confession to police that he was involved in the burglary. And after 3 years of incarceration, Scarpelli challenged the revocation because he was not afforded a hearing. It was all administratively done. And the state of Wisconsin argued that his probation was violated for two legitimate reasons. He'd been associated with felons, and he had committed the crime that he confessed to. And the Supreme Court held in an 8-1 decision that he was still entitled to that process, and only after a preliminary and a final revocation hearing had been held. He didn't get either. He just had administrative revocation.
Hey, would you go back and tell me what the split was on that Supreme Court decision?
8-1.
That's a pretty solid decision, don't you think?
It was a bunch of damn liberals back in 72 running that court.
I'd say that. So it seems that that this sounds very much like extradition, but you claim it's not an extradition. Would you be so kind to describe what a retaking is like if it is not an extradition?
Well, the process for returning an offender to the sending state is described in Chapter 4 of the Bench Book for Judges and Court Personnel, and that's on the Interstate Compact website. The definitions of ascending state and receiving state are clearly defined in Rule 1.101, and the ICOS rules are contained in the bench book, and the discretion of a sending state to retake an offender is limited by several factors. And first, a sending state must retake an offender upon request of the receiving state if they've been convicted of a new felony offense. And of course, they can only retake them after they complete any term of incarceration. But a sending state is required to retake an offender upon the request of the receiving state and is showing that the offender has committed three or more significant violations arising from separate incidents that establish a pattern of noncompliance with the terms of supervision. And that's in Rule 5.103. Now, I think that's been modified. They may have made a little more latitude for that, but you have to be violating your probation, your supervision, before they can force you out of the state.
I think at this point we're almost done. We're close to wrapping it up. But could you define what a significant violation is? What else did I write?
Well, that's defined in the bench book. A significant violation is defined as a violation of the terms and conditions of supervision such that if it had occurred in the receiving state, it would result in a request for revocation of supervision. And that's in Rule 1.101 again. So if a supervising officer in Alabama says, boy, if you had been convicted here and you did this violation, I would be filing a petition to revoke. That is all it takes if it would rise to that level. But it's important to note that the gravity of the violation is measured by the standards of the receiving state. So Alabama gets to decide how important that violation is in terms of starting the process, but only the sending state can actually revoke the probation. You could get back to the sending state and they can say, you know, that's the craziest thing we've ever heard of in our life. We're not going to revoke you for that. They could do that. But it is really up to the receiving state to set the standard of what they will accept in terms of behavior and how serious they view a violation. And if it's determined that the violations meet the standards of receiving state, the sending state is obligated to retake that offender. They're not obligated to revoke them, but they're obligated to retake them. And that's the difference. They can say, you come back here. You're not functioning very well on out-of-state supervision. We'll supervise you here. But that's not the same thing as revoking you. But a receiving state can force their offender to return to the state after being shown that these violations are occurring and they're not responding well to supervision and the out-of-state jurisdiction.
Now, so I think we're pretty close to wrapping this up. Without being vague, and I don't want anybody to be vague, that's what Scalia was talking about. What is the definition of a significant violation? Because that sounds like that would have a huge margin of error.
Well, it's been a while. We did another one like at 265, but we didn't get as deep into it as we did tonight. But yeah, we haven't spent a lot of time on interstate combat, so this was good.
Is that a new mail subscriber that we picked up there? I see Roger.
Yes, last week we picked up a new subscriber.
Oh, and I also saw somebody on the actual Registry Matters website posted a comment that she would like to have a transcript sent to her son as well.
Well, all I need is information, and we can turn it over to our mail processing and distribution people, and it'll happen.
Now, is that you?
It is me.
All right. Well, head over to registrymatters.co, not .com, just .co. Long story, I don't even remember at this point, but it's not a .com. It's a .co. And that's where the show notes are, and you can find links to places like how to leave a voicemail, which is 747-227-4477. Email registrymatterscast, and of course, if you would like to be so kind to support us on Patreon. Oh my God, okay, all right, hold on. So an individual who was our transcriptionist before, he was not very, very employed, and now he's got a high dollar job, and he quadrupled his Patreonage. And he's been bugging me about mentioning him. So now he has been mentioned. And he did that over at patreon.com/registrymatters.
So he went from $1 to $4,
yes,
right?
That is a $1 to $4 Patreon increase. Or okay, it's a $1,400 to four times stimulus check. All right, so we got to leave. I'll leave that to be also vague. And if you have any parting words before we get out of here?
I always fail. All right, I have nothing else.
Well, thank you, everybody, for coming out and hanging out. I appreciate it so very much. And we'll see you in a week. And have a great night, everybody.
You've been listening to FYP.